Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. This episode, your co-hosts are myself, Terry Hutchinson, and Kevin Christensen, and Mark Johnson. And our Come Follow Me topic today will be sections 125 through 128 of the Doctrine and Covenants. The Interpreter Foundation is a group of volunteers who are put together in order to support the teachings, doctrines, and practices of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through faithful scholarship. Now, if you like this podcast, you can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where there's a lot of different options. There are journal articles, books, symposia, conferences, videos, as well as docudramas and a lot of other material, as study aids, not to mention these podcasts. And it is a 501c3 corporation where you can donate and know that your money is going almost 100% to the efforts of the foundation and its various projects. You can designate what your projects are, and it's all visible on the website. There's a lot on the website. Also, you can, if you enjoy this, please tell your friends. Give us a like, give us a review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. So that being said, this episode, as I mentioned, we will be talking about Doctrine and Covenants, section 125 through 128. And we're going to begin by having either Mark or Kevin, perhaps both, tell us a little overview of this section of the Doctrine and Covenants that we will be covering.
I can do that very quickly. The first two sections that we're going to discuss, section 125 and 126, those sections are small revelations. The first one is given to Joseph Smith, talking about God's will concerning the territories around Nauvoo. The second revelation, section 126, discusses Brigham Young and his service, how it was pleasing to the Lord. And then the next two sections, section 127 and 128, are really new and exciting things for the saints. They are epistles from Joseph Smith where he discusses the idea of baptism for the dead. And this was a great idea, or a pretty bold idea at the time for the saints and Christianity pretty much in general. I mean, it's been gone for, 2,000 years or so. It's back. And Joseph Smith talks about it and introduces it, and we'll talk a lot about it.
Well, there are a couple of things, too, in DNC 128 in particular that I think will be interesting to talk about. That overall, it's an epistle, as Mark said, about baptism for the dead. But I've got a couple of passages marked in here that aren't really so much to do with baptism for the dead as how we can see revelation happening. In the first verse, he says, "I now resume the subject of baptism for the dead, as that subject seems to occupy my mind and press itself upon my feelings the strongest since I have been pursued by mine enemies." So there's that sense of that it's something that, just the topic itself is suggesting itself to him as something that is going to be urgent. And then there's another verse in verse 18. This one I've referred to a couple times in my essays. After he's quoting a scripture, he says, "I might have rendered a plainer translation to this, but it is sufficiently plain to suit my purpose as it stands. It is sufficient to know in this case," and he goes on talking about this passage in Malachi, but I like the general principle that he's stating there, that a translation can be sufficiently plain for a particular purpose. And so that, I think that gets away from the idea of something happening to be absolutely perfect and unchangeable, and the only one possible, because he's just kind of disavowing that. And just, I think it's a great attitude to scripture, and it kind of takes away the fretting about imperfection and to just approach things with a sense of possibility.
The subject of the baptism for the dead, particularly at this era, there's a lot of really good supplementary material on it, in addition to what we find in the scriptures themselves. Particularly, I'm thinking of Richard E. Bennett, or Alexander Baugh talking about the principle as it came out. I think Alexander Baugh did an article in BYU Studies that was later reprinted, and it's pretty easy to find if you go online, that talks about how this baptism for the dead idea first was practiced and how it came out. And if I remember right, Richard E. Bennett also did one, and he said, "I want to be baptized for thousands more." I mean, the vision of the early brethren with when they caught this idea was stunning, and I think they would be gratified to see the things that technology has enabled us to accomplish. And yet, I think if we look at the scope of what's still to be done, the technology that we have is about the same in perspective as what the early saints had when it came to knowing who their ancestors were. There really wasn't much material at all. So they used the available technology and research that they had and the memories in order to try and do this work and get the names in order to perform the ordinances. They knew and loved the fact that ordinances needed to be performed. And what I'd ask you guys is, there's a brother in my ward who kind of poses this question sometimes. Why are we doing these ordinances? What's the point of the ordinances themselves? I mean, we have on the surface kind of is why we're asked to do it or commanded to do it, but what is the underlying principle of that we think?
Yeah, well,
Just out of curiosity.
yeah, I mean, the New Testament is pretty clear where he says that, except a man be, we have to be baptized, that everyone's supposed to be baptized. But then as history and life goes on, there are people, many people who haven't been granted the opportunity. And Nibley wrote the essay, one of his first essays. He did a multi-part study of, the writings of the early Christians on the topic of baptism for the dead. I think it's back in the 50s, early 50s, or even late 40s, was it? But it got some notice. But he's raising that issue. Do you have a command that is meaningless, or do you have a command that's cruel? And how do you bridge the gap? And it was a pressing issue in Joseph Smith's own family, because they'd had the criticism of Alvin when Alvin had died. The minister saying, well, he hadn't been baptized, so he can't be buried, with respect, and he'll be damned, this kind of thing. So they had that kind of criticism and dilemma, many of them in their own families, because there was a lot more infant mortality back in those days, and there were more people dying younger, so that there was people were a lot more acquainted with seeing loved ones pass on, and sometimes seeing them pass on before these ordinances are done. So there's just this question: well, what about the people that haven't been baptized? What can be done for them? And so the one approach would be to be heartless about it. So they'll say they didn't keep the law; they have to be punished, for eternity, and there's nothing that God can do about it because the law is the law. Or the people saying, well, it really doesn't matter, so what's the point of being baptized? And then baptism becomes watered down that way. But what Joseph Smith is revealed to him in this part of the Nauvoo period is the thing that shows how the law is important, that everyone, but then brings in the opportunity for everyone through vicarious ordinances to be able to accept or reject that covenant. And when he, the passages that he talks about in here, when you read D&C 128, are very powerful, and they're dealing with things that he's experienced, with the sealing and the power and the emerging temple ordinances, and the idea that baptism is important. So it's all here, and he quotes from Paul about this, and he talks about angelic messengers coming at various times to restore the priesthood, and there's some very powerful witnesses of the priesthood restorations in section 128. So it's making it something that it's both just and fair and merciful. It's all of those things. It's just, it's fair, it's merciful, and it's powerfully symbolic. The idea of the baptismal ordinance. I remember years ago reading some books by Eliade and things, where they're talking about comparative world ritual. And this is the most basic symbolism of rituals all throughout the world is literally being born again. It's a rebirth, death and rebirth. I think Eliade wrote a book called that, Death and Rebirth. And so this idea is to when you make the covenant to become a new person, to die and be born again as something new and different. And there's things like when Elma's conversion thinks, famously, he describes himself as being born anew. And there's the imagery all through the New Testament. And when Jesus himself is baptized, thus to fulfill all righteousness, to demonstrate obedience to that and to set an example for us. So all of these things can come together in a way that is both just and fair and merciful. Well, all three, all just and fair and merciful. And it comes through these saving ordinances so that those who didn't get the chance can be given it. And he says that they without us cannot be made perfect. The idea that it's recognizing the mutual independence of generations of humanity, that we're all in this together, even those that have passed on, which I think is a beautiful thought.
Mark?
Yes. I agree with everything Kevin has said. What else would you like to ask me?
Well, one of the things that that comes out in this baptism for the dead, it started with Samuel Brunson in August of 1840. And I think that's really the first time Joseph did that. I know there's a project out there where someone is preparing a collection of the funeral sermons given by the prophet Joseph Smith. And a lot of times he would share doctrine in those funerals. And we kind of saw an example of that recently with the funeral of President Nelson, of course. We'll be doing an episode where we talk a little more about the funeral and the purpose of it. But it's fascinating to me that we think about this, but also this business about baptism for the dead is something that we know was something they were doing anciently. But it's fascinating how commentators have striven to try and explain that. I mean, the traditional commentators, in one of them, and I think it was in the New International Commentary on the New Testament, Gordon Fee said that there were at least 40 different solutions for baptism for the dead. 40. And the number of explanations of 1 Corinthians verse 29 of chapter 15 that have been proposed in the words of, and I want to say Joseph Fitzmyer, who was a Catholic, he says it's legion. And of the legion, Fitzmyer, anyway, admits that the one used by the majority of interpreters today is that living Christians underwent vicarious or proxy baptism. In other words, water baptism in the Christian rite on behalf of persons or relatives who had died without being baptized, so that those persons might be saved or gain access to the kingdom of God. And in fact, he says the rest of the argument is directed at the community as a whole in being baptized, apparently vicariously, in behalf of some people who had already died, and that reading is a plain understanding of the text. So really, and I think it's Fee who says, if you read the Greek, that's exactly what you would picture it to be, except for one problem. He says there are difficulties involved. And of course, those difficulties are we don't really recognize baptism for the dead. We don't recognize vicarious ordinances. And there's a group out there who does, but we don't want to mention them. And we don't want to say, oh, there's a possibility that they might have something going on there. But
Shame. It's a shame, isn't
it
it?
is. It really is. But certain ancient beliefs, this kind of tracks with certain ancient beliefs. Richard Bauckham, in his book, The Fate of the Dead, talked about how, according to the Epistle of the Apostles, Christ not only preached, but he baptized the righteous dead. Now, that's not quite how we view it. That's certainly not what we find in Doctrine and Covenants 138. But the idea of the baptizing of the dead is found in Hermas, where it is not Christ, but the apostles and teachers of the first Christian generation who preached Christ and administered baptism to the dead. And from the Shepherd of Hermas is considered in conjunction with this, and Hugh Nibley talked about this. He quoted this, and I want to say it's in this one of these articles that Kevin was talking about that I
Yeah, it's in
believe.
1948.
Yeah, I think we can. It's collected in volume four, right? Early,
Yes. Here,
okay.
yeah, Mormonism
Volume
and
four of the
Exclusivism.
collected works of Hugh Nibley.
Yep.
There it is. All right. See, and this is why it's handy to have your library when you're podcasting. I actually do, but I don't have access to anything that we're using. My library, and I'm sad to admit this, is at least two-thirds of it is based on the way it looks to the general public instead of being useful. Mark, anyway, I don't want to say any more
No
than that.
worries.
I'll be in trouble.
Fair enough.
But,
I got you.
Nibley says that the seal of the preaching is, of course, the water. Kevin, I believe you're looking at page 122.
No, I was starting a little bit earlier than that, but I can,
Okay.
page
Yeah.
122, yeah.
Yeah. There's also an article by Gloria Frank called Christ's Descent to the Underworld in Ancient Ritual and Legend. And that's a fascinating article that kind of covers some of these ancient beliefs that track. And I remember distinctly, as early as the ninth grade, for an honors English class, putting together a paper on the journeys to the land of the dead by Odysseus in the Odyssey, and also Virgil, Aeneas in Virgil's Aeneid, and how they were together, and then tying them in with Dante and his vision. And it's something that's been a fascination to the ancients and everybody. And I know I don't want to get it very much farther off the track of what we're talking about here for baptism for the dead, but it's certainly not something that is unrecognizable when you look at antiquity.
And yeah, and the problems and the questions raised without it are, I think, are troubling. You know, like Dante's solution is not very appealing to me, certainly. You know, with the idea of purgatory and he's supposed to learn by his experience to not have mercy. You know, because if someone's guilty of something, then you shouldn't be merciful. You should just, side with God against them, because if they're down there being punished, then you're supposed to join in part of that. So there's something to me inherently unchristlike about it. And the way that it comes together in these things that Joseph Smith is starting to put together in these revelations, and how he's tying it back, when there's this passage here where he says, this is in verse 19, where he's already mentioned, for we without them cannot be made perfect, neither can they without us be made perfect. And then he goes on and talks about the keys, and he says, now what we hear in the gospel which we have received, a voice of gladness, a voice of mercy from heaven, a voice of truth out of the earth, glad tidings for the dead, a voice of gladness for the living and the dead, glad tidings of great joy. How beautiful upon the mountain are the feet of those that bring glad tidings of good things, that say unto Zion, behold, thy God reigneth. As the dews of Carmel, so shall the knowledge of God descend upon them. And then he starts talking about the revelations that he's received over many years in many places. So there's this kind of joy and enthusiasm that I think really comes across. And I think in reading, the way that people have wrestled with these questions in different ways, I think that's one of the things that sets me up to get on board with Joseph Smith, because I can see why he's excited about it, because they've had the personal wrestling with the question, and when he started, he did not know that he was going to get to these answers. It's something that isn't talked about in the Book of Mormon. That talks about baptism in beautiful ways, certainly, but about the ordinance of for the dead, they're not spelled out there. But of course, we're told that we're not going to have everything in the Doctrine and Covenants, and I think, or in the Book of Mormon. But we do have these additional revelations from the Doctrine and Covenants, and we see this unfold over time with the different things that he's taught and revealed. And then, later has the meaning and purpose explained to him. And here you get, you kind of, I can just feel the enthusiasm and the joy in what he's saying. Like in the King Follett discourse, he says, "Isn't this good doctrine? It tastes good." And it does taste good. It's joyful, and it doesn't come from nowhere, because there are all these passages, conspicuous passages, in 1 Corinthians 15:29 that we're real familiar with, and others, other early Christian documents that mention and make it clear that this was an early Christian thing and then got lost. So it's something that's clearly part of the restoration of all things, and so it's exciting and inspiring. And then we also have the experience that we've got temples now all over the place, and most of the wards I've been in, one of the things that they do for the young people is they take them to the temple and encourage them when they're quite young to go into the temple and to participate in baptisms for the dead, so that they can actually do it. And when I hear young people talking about their first experience doing it, they all have been, just feel like they've been part of something larger than themselves that is real.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we haven't really emphasized yet during this letter, because the baptism for the dead, the ordinances for the dead, are associated with the temple specifically. And it's in Nauvoo where we really get the fullness of the temple ordinances that were revealed to Joseph Smith.
Yeah, it's exciting
And
to see all those things come together.
they're still there today. In a different episode, which I think is going to drop here in early October, John Gee and John Thompson and I interviewed Jonathan Stapley. That was a challenge, me and the three Johnnies. But we talked about Jonathan's book called Holiness to the Lord, which is published by Oxford, and it's a history, kind of a history of the temple endowment and the temple ordinances and the temple itself, in a very, in a very positive way. He was very thorough about telling us from public sources and church-approved sources about what really is in the endowment. And it made it's very visible to people who've always wondered about that. But one of the things that was pointed out was that it used to be that when you were eight, you could go to the temple and do baptisms for the dead. And then they kind of restricted that, and now they've expanded it a little bit again, and now we have 12-year-olds who are able to do it, and 11-year-olds in some instances. So, one of the things from one of these other sections, really quick, the one about Iowa. When I read this one, obviously what happened is some of the saints settled across the river in Iowa, which is a different state. At that time, it was a different territory. Now it's a different state. And it reminded me of a family trip we made to Nauvoo back before the temple was announced and rebuilt, back in 1988. And we were there for Thanksgiving, and there really wasn't anywhere in Nauvoo to have a Thanksgiving dinner or anything else. And so we drove across the river to Iowa, where they had a bigger city and they had something with a little more for us. But it just makes me think of how close the Iowa territories were to Nauvoo. I mean, really, all you had to do was cross the river. Now, granted, crossing the river at that time was not a mere hop, skip, and a jump. So let me clarify the word only. I'm using very loosely. But, it's like one of the things we ran into with our interview with Jonathan was Joseph Smith started the washings and anointings that we talk about in the Nauvoo Temple. And so there's a passage there where we say, oh, he washed himself with water and anointed himself. And you don't think about the fact that they didn't have running water, they didn't have water heaters. And in fact, this was January in Illinois, where it was common for people not to bathe until spring because you just never did that. And yet, here's Joseph, as well as the other brethren, going through the effort of heating water, bathing with water, making sure their clothes are clean and pure, and then scenting themselves with an anointed oil and, with some spices in it, in order to set themselves aside, just as they did with in the ancient times. And so, I mean, these sections right here in this passage of sections for me in the Doctrine and Covenants is really where we start to get more of a practical hold of the vision of the ordinances as we know and recognize them today. So, how about some of these others, Mark?
One of the things that strikes me is section 136, talking about Brigham Young and all the work he did.
Oh, yeah.
I found on the interpreter website a resource by John Claiborne, who contributes a lot to the interpreter site. He lists some of Brigham Young's accomplishments and works. He has in 1832, Brigham traveled and preached in New York and Ohio, beginning only a week after his baptism, even. And this was even before he met Joseph Smith. 1833, he continued preaching in Canada, traveling back and forth several times. During all this time, these early years, his wife, first wife Miriam, died of tuberculosis, and then he married Marianne Angel. In 1834, Brigham helped build the Kirtland Temple and participated in the Zion's Camp March to Missouri and back. 1835, he was ordained an apostle and called to preach to the Native American tribes in New York and then in Canada again, and then another mission in Vermont and Massachusetts. 1836, he preached throughout New England again, including New York, Vermont, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Maine. He baptized his cousin Willard Richards. 1837, Brigham and Willard traveled throughout New England. Went to actual England. Let's see, in the next few years, in 1840 and 1841, the apostles there resulted in over 5,000 new converts the first year there alone. And yeah, he did a lot. He was a busy man. I think if I could get that much done in that amount of time, well, I'd be impressed. I'll just leave it at that. He was a busy man, and he earned this little respite from the Lord.
Well, I do know that the foundation is working on a series of documentaries and docudramas and internet shorts called Becoming Brigham, which focuses on the life of Brigham and the things that led up to him being the president of the church. And as a younger man, I have to confess, I always held Joseph in high esteem, but Brigham, I struggled with. I mean, we only have one revelation from him in the Doctrine and Covenants. I mean, come on. Come on. Really? Come
How
on.
much of a prophet could he have been if he only gave us one?
Exactly. Exactly. Kevin, try not to stone me.
Yeah, I won't. No.
I know. I know. But I remember reading with fascination, and then my wife reading Leonard Arrington's book, American Moses. It changed my life because I got to know Brigham in a real and valid way. And the takeaway I had was something that was reinforced at the interpreter birthday a couple of years ago. Garrett Dirkmott gave us a talk about Brigham and how closely he followed in Joseph's footsteps and Joseph's teachings. And that was something I got out of the Brigham Young biography as well. And I have been a big Brigham Young fan and supporter ever since. Not that I really wasn't, but sometimes we don't have a full knowledge or understanding, or I think a better word is an appreciation for some of the brethren.
I got it from reading some of Hugh Nibley's essays, that are collected in Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints, especially Brigham Young and the Enemy and Brigham Young on the Environment. And then Eugene England talking about Brigham as being he said that he's the greatest master of English that we had, and so the Brigham Young Priesthood Manual, it's my favorite just for the power of the language. Plus, about the idea of Brigham having revelations. Many years ago, wrote an essay called "Nigh Unto Death: Near Death Experience Research in the Book of Mormon." If I wrote it now, I would want to mention that Brigham Young had a near-death experience on Nauvoo, or not Nauvoo, in winter quarters, and that there are many, many places in his discourses where he talks about the afterlife, and he does so in a way that shows a far more intimate experience with it than you get anywhere in the scriptures. You know, there's things in there that you can read in other near-death experiences since his time, but he was talking about it back then. And there's a famous experience that Jedediah Grant had, that Heber C. Kimball reported in General Conference, that Jedi Grant had fallen and injured himself, and while he was in there with Kimball, he died for a while and came back, and the first thing he said to Heber C. Kimball was, "Why, it was just as Brigham has told us many times," which I think is it's wonderful. So I think the idea that he was just a practical man and not a spiritual man—that's one of the things that Dan Peterson especially is wanting to challenge with these things, to show that Brigham Young was a deeply spiritual person, and I've grown to appreciate that more and more. And I love his language.
Well, one of the things that Dan and the interpreter have been emphasizing is Gene Carruth, who has been taking Brigham's speeches and retranslating them essentially from the Pittman shorthand of that time. And his words are a lot softer and more congenial, I should say, to the
There's more kind
listener
of a less authoritarian, and it's kind of.
than his kind of rough that we've always had. There's a different side to him that's coming out in his language and everything that makes it it gives him an even more well-rounded an approach that helps me appreciate him more, and that's something that we're bringing out.
Oh yeah, and there's also, I mean, besides the shorthand accounts, there's an interview that was just recently transcribed with Brigham Young in the Deseret Alphabet that it's only been translated recently, and that gives some insight on the period, in the wake of the Mount Meadows massacre, showing that Brigham Young was definitely not involved.
Oh,
He'd
yeah.
been lied to by the participants.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious when you take a look at the two Mountain Meadows books that were put together with the support of the church. The most recent one, of course, we had Rick Turley and Barbara Brown on our program when we were broadcasting on the radio, and you can find that on the foundation website, by the way. So, Kevin, this near-death experience, is that the one where Brigham saw Joseph?
And where Joseph Smith says, "Tell the people to get the spirit of the Lord, it will take away all bitterness and malice and hatred from their hearts." So it's just that kind of message, where that's the message that he's concerned with, and that he's told, I wish I could be with you, and he said, "But we've got a lot to do here, and you've got a lot to do there." But there's that just that just pure love of Christ, that charity, that trying to become peacemakers and givers, and to live Christ-like lives. There's that kind of urgency and joy in it that you get there from Brigham Young, and it comes out of real experience and things that he's done. And so there's the Brigham Young Priesthood Manual has an entire chapter called "The Spirit World." It's the only one that has that, and I've grown to appreciate it more and more, especially because of the stuff I've read in near-death experience research, and realized he's speaking from experience. He's not speculating or guessing or just quoting somebody else. He's talking about where he's been and what he's seen. And he does so in a way that shows that there's a reverence for it. It's when he talks about it, it's quite often at funerals. So he's wanting to share it because at that moment in that place, it's the comfort people need. And that's when he gives it. He's not showing off. He's offering the kind of comfort that he's been prepared by that experience to be able to give. And it's when you read it in comparison with his much later accounts by other people, you appreciate just how extraordinary it is that he was in an environment where he could talk about it and share it, and that people just accepted it. because, from the revelations to Joseph Smith at the start, that it kind of opens the door to be able to talk about it. When so many people, when they have an experience like this, they realize that they can't share it because people won't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that really makes me appreciate some of the things we talked about in our earlier discussion on baptism for the dead, is just that eschatological sense, just that sense of there is a another side, to the veil.
Yes.
There's a veil, there is a spirit world. And as you were talking about, as Terry was talking about the number of Bible critics and scholars who are unwilling to look at 1 Corinthians 15:29 at face value, it seems that that's tied right to their point of view of is there more beyond this or not? If there's not, if there in their view is not more beyond this, if there isn't a spirit world beyond this, then yeah, that verse isn't going to make a lot of sense. But me, I believe in that. I have that viewpoint. I haven't had a near-death experience, but it's something my testimony is really based on. Is the reality of the other side. And I get promptings and nudges and taps on the shoulder every once in a while about different ancestors that need some work done, or friends
Or the
that
ones that need to spend more time in spirit prison, right?
yes, also them too. Just the reality of that is occasionally strong enough for me where I don't have a problem with this idea of baptisms for the dead, or really any other aspect of the gospel. Everything rings true to me because every once in a while I get the other side reaching out to me in quiet and subtle ways, through whatever promptings I'm getting. And
Yeah.
I think if more of us looked at our own spiritual promptings, kind of in that light, then that might make our testimonies a little stronger and make us a little more durable to the challenges that come along.
Yeah, we've had some of those experiences in our family too. On a final note, in DNC 127, Joseph is in hiding, and yet he's writing to support the saints. This is the one where he famously says, "Deep water is what I am wont to swim in."
Yes.
It's all become a second nature to me. I feel like Paul to glory in tribulation, for to this day has the God of my fathers delivered me out of them all and will deliver me from henceforth. For behold, and lo, I shall triumph over my enemies, for the Lord God has spoken it. Well, what do we mean by triumph? Certainly they killed him, but they didn't. He didn't die, and then I love this verse 4, and again, verily, thus saith the Lord. Now Joseph's in hiding, but this is what he says to the saints: Let the work of my temple and all the works which I have appointed unto you be continued on and not cease, and let your diligence and your perseverance and patience and your works be redoubled. And you shall in no wise lose your reward, saith the Lord of hosts. And I think we could say that about President Nelson. He's gone, and yet, you know what? The temples are still operating, the work is still going forward, the church is still being guided by living prophets and apostles. And so, literally, that is an admonition to all of us. But notice, let the work of my temple and all the works which I have appointed unto you be continued on and not cease. Just keep going. And the temple is the heart of that. And I think this section really emphasizes the temple, especially the way that you both have brought up and brought out the temple ordinances and the baptism of the dead. So I want to thank you for doing that. And we encourage all of you to take a look at these and also look at some of the resources that the church has to offer on your Gospel Library app. And they're in many languages now. And also, the Interpreter Foundation has a lot of assets on its website. So just go and check them out. We want to thank you for your attention for this episode of the Interpreter Foundation podcast. This is Terry Hutchinson, along with Kevin Christensen and Mark Johnson, signing off. Thank you for listening.